It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. History tells us that the extraction economy is boom or bust. Just a few years ago, frac sand mining in Wisconsin was booming. Now, a northern Wisconsin frac sand company may be filing for bankruptcy. So, does that mean the boom is over? We'll hear from WPR reporter Rich Kramer from our Eau Claire Bureau, who's been covering the frac sand industry for years. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, John.
Tell us a bit about Emerge Energy, how significant this company is in the Wisconsin frac sand market, and what kind of economic impact it's had.
Well, Emerge Energy is one of what I would call the bigger players in Wisconsin. You've got mines all across the state. Most of them are in the western portion, kind of between concentrated in like Trempealeau counties, Chippewa counties, Barron counties. That's kind of been the hot spot since the 2010 timeframe. And Superior Silica came in. They've got a number of mines and a pretty large processing facility. They made some major investments. We're talking about plants. One of their facilities in the town of Clinton in Barron County is, it's on the order of $60, $70 million. It's a big facility enclosed under a roof. Just a massive, massive building. So they've been quite visible. They entered into some partnerships with Canadian National Rail Line. I mean, they've been making news for a while. So each of their mines, you know, at the peak, they were saying that each of the mines could hire around 30 people. So it's a fair number of employees that work there.
So what's happening that it now appears that Emerge Energy might have to file for bankruptcy? What if is the frac sand business in Wisconsin diminishing?
Well, it's been kind of in decline since 2015. I would say that 2014 was kind of the high watermark for sand companies in Wisconsin. And there's a couple of reasons that it's changed. First of all, oil prices per barrel at around 2014 were over $100 per barrel. And that is quite high compared to what we're looking at now. I think now we're in the $60 to maybe $70 range. And that's significant because sand from Wisconsin, while it might be pretty cheap to get out of the ground, it has to be shipped to the oil fields that are producing right now. And for the last few years, the Permian Basin, which is in West Texas, has been the hotspot in the nation. So, and what's been happening in Texas is a lot of companies said, well, to heck with shipping the sand across the country, we'll just start building sand mines in the dunes near these oil fields. And the companies have found that sand works pretty well. And in fact, it works just fine. So they can get that sand out of the ground and to the oil wells cheaper than it costs just to ship it from Wisconsin. So even though Wisconsin sand is considered higher quality, it's just too expensive to ship.
So ongoing oversupply issues in Wisconsin sand, how much of an impact is this going to have on the frac sand industry? How many companies are likely to close up, or how many mines are likely to close up because of this?
Well, this is what surprised me. I mean, I've been hearing from different analysts and different companies that, well, the industry, the market is shifting. You know, there's more of this, what they call in-basin sand happening in Texas. So that has kind of squeezed out Wisconsin sand from some of the busiest parts of the nation. And so it was kind of predicted that this was going to cause impacts. And I just kept hearing that, well, maybe. Now the number has jumped. I've heard a couple people say that they expect that half of the mines in Wisconsin would have to close, either temporarily, some permanently. But one of my real trusted frac sand industry analysts says that up to 75% of the mines might have to close because there's just a major oversupply. They told me that the sand mines in Texas are now capable of producing over 100 million tons of sand per year. And to put that in context, the anticipated entire demand for the entire country is just maybe 120, 130 million tons. So that sand in Texas is really displacing what they call northern white from Wisconsin.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. We're talking about the nationwide oversupply of frac sand. Texas isn't the only place it's being used. Wasn't a lot of Wisconsin frac sand going to North Dakota at one point?
That is true, but what I'm hearing from analysts also is that while there is oil activity going on in North Dakota, I'm hearing that it's not anywhere near in scale to what's going on in Texas. Also, what I heard, and I don't want to get into too much jargon here, but the analysts tell me that North Dakota has what are considered tier two oil wells. And it just costs more money to get the oil out. The wells don't last as long. They kind of, it's just the reserves are not as plentiful as they are in Texas. So it's too capital intensive to operate there. And when times are good, when oil is well over $100 a barrel, it doesn't matter. That's the thing. So that's what we saw in 2014.
But so unless tighter, oil prices spike again, it looks like the sand industry in Wisconsin is kind of in a downward spiral here.
Yeah, and it has been for some years now. But things seem to be like the big maybe was, well, maybe oil prices will increase and maybe this sand supply will kind of balance itself out. And what I'm hearing now is that people in the sand market or people in the oil drilling industry kind of expect that the local sand from Texas and other places is probably a permanent thing. And it's good enough. So now it sounds like some companies are starting to consider just reclaiming their mines.
So what does that mean? When the mines shut down, what happens?
All right. So state law dictates that when you shut down a mine, you basically have to fill in the hole. You have to recontour the land to certain specifications. And then you have to, when they first open a mine, they strip all the vegetation and the topsoil off and kind of put it in a pile off to the side. So when you recontour that land, you have to take that topsoil and spread it back over the land, and then you have to reseed it. You got to make it either agricultural use, prairie, or forest. So that's all spelled out, but the question is how it is paid for. These projects are not cheap, and also we don't have, I mean, there's one sand mine company, Badger Mining, that's been in Wisconsin for over 100 years, so they've got some reclaimed mines to give as an example, but a lot of these companies have never done this. A lot of these companies were kind of created to respond to the market of the 2010 to 2014 period.
And what happens if they declare bankruptcy and walk away? I mean, what's our option here? We've only got about 30 seconds left.
Sure. All right. So counties and have been demanding bonds. Basically, you set aside money to pay for this, but what I'm hearing from analysts also is that there's a chance that these bonds are backed up with the company's own assets. So if the company goes out of business, there's a chance that they might not be able to live up to that. But a lot of bonds are cash bonds, so it shouldn't matter. But it's just going to be a big, big question.
Rich, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Jeff.
Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. He's also host of The West Side. Coming up next, 10 years after America's Great Recessions, wages are on the rise, but for everybody, we'll find out. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. 10 years after America's most recent Great Recession, wages are finally on the rise. But not everyone is benefiting. In Wisconsin, we see that play out in Milwaukee, where a growing Hispanic population is essential to the regional economy, but gaps in wages are very persistent. What questions do you have about economic trends in southeastern Wisconsin? Are you a member of the Hispanic community in the greater Milwaukee area? What can you share about your economic situation? Do you feel your community is advancing? Maybe you're an educator. What do you think we can do to make progress for underrepresented populations? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the conversation. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's the author of the recent report, Upward Mobility, Assessing the Characteristics of Greater Milwaukee's Growing Hispanic Workforce. Joe, good morning, and welcome back to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What do we know about the growing Hispanic population in southeastern Wisconsin and specifically the greater Milwaukee area? Is this a rising demographic, and how fast is it rising?
Yeah, it is a quickly growing demographic. In fact, the fastest growing in the Milwaukee area. So what we found is that since 2000, the Hispanic Latino population has grown by over 75,000 in the Milwaukee area, which is like adding the entire population of an Appleton or Eau Claire to the region just in that time period. At the same time, the population wouldn't have grown without the growth in the Hispanic Latino population. It would have remained flat otherwise. So really important that population has been growing and contributing to the workforce and the economy.
Well, let's talk about the economic impact. What did your study find there?
So, what we did first is we set out to do is to understand how the Hispanic workforce compares with the broader workforce in the region with regard to educational attainment and wages, and how their occupations compare with where jobs are growing. And part of doing that, we looked at recent high school graduates and what they're doing as far as college enrollment and completion. And so what we found, first of all, when we looked at just the broader workforce, the adult population, we found that Hispanics have been growing in almost every occupation in number. So they've been filling jobs as other populations have declined. But we see major disparities in the wages in the occupations that they're concentrated in. So specifically, we found that every occupation that pays a median annual wage of $60,000 or higher, Hispanics are very underrepresented in all those fields, and many of those are quickly growing in the region. Things like healthcare, so specifically the higher wage doctor and nurse type positions in the healthcare industry, things like management and finance and tech. Those are all fields that are growing in the Milwaukee area and pay relatively well, and Hispanics are very underrepresented in those areas.
Why might that be the case?
There's definitely a number of factors that could be contributing to that. When we looked at UW-Milwaukee specifically, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, because more Hispanic students are enrolled there than any other four-year institution in the area. And we found that a majority of the Hispanic students there qualify for federal Pell Grants, so that's sort of an indicator of lower income families. We found that a majority, over 60% of the Hispanic students are first generation, so they don't have a parent that has gone through college and can help provide guidance for that process. So those are a couple of big factors that are maybe contributing to college and career outcomes. There's a smaller percentage that would fall into that dreamer category, the people who, have grown up here and are going to college now, but are undocumented. So that was, UWM estimated about 10% of their Hispanic students fall in that category. So there are a number of challenges and barriers that could be influencing their outcomes.
Let's talk a little bit about educational attainment as a factor in maybe not seeing the Hispanic community get into some of these higher paying jobs. The attainment of young Hispanics, not enough to close the gaps we're seeing in wages and professional positions. Break that down for us.
Yeah, so another part of our study was that we were able to get data on about 45,000 students who graduated from Milwaukee high schools over a 10-year period, recent 10-year period. And that included, you know, over 8,500 Hispanic students. And so what we were able to do is get data that tracked those students to see whether they enrolled in any college nationwide, and then what their outcomes were, if they graduated, what degrees they earned, what majors they had. And so that was a really rich data set to help us understand what those students are doing. And what we found is that, you know, there are increasing numbers of Hispanic students going into college and completing college. So the trend is definitely positive, but, you know, the attainment is still, there are still big disparities in terms of college completion. For example, we found that among those 45,000 students I mentioned, the Hispanic students were more likely to have completed a short sort of technical diploma or certificate. So those are programs that take like a year or less to complete. And they were less likely to have completed a bachelor's degree or an advanced degree than non-Hispanic. So that was one gap that we saw in the data. We also found disparities at some of the area colleges and universities in terms of the graduation rates between Hispanic and non-Hispanic students, which you know, like, could be influenced by some of the things I mentioned before.
So is this then about not having the resources to complete a longer program?
It can be. Certainly at UW-Milwaukee, they've identified that financial, you know, the finances are the most common issue that causes Hispanic students to drop out. And so, you know, they're making more concerted efforts to focus on first and second year students and try to really help with retaining those students by providing extra support and advising. So, yeah, certainly finances are an issue, and there are just bigger challenges for these students, and they may need more support in many cases to complete the programs.
We have a caller on the line. Tom is with us from Port Wayne. Port Wayne, Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, I lived down in the Rio Grande Valley for over 10 years, and this mirrors exactly what the indigenous Hispanic population of the valley said, that the constant increase in the number of people surging into their area caused their wages to not increase, but to stay at a flat line. And that's because there's a constant surge of people coming in, and they gravitate to the same areas where other Hispanics are living. So
Tom, we're almost out of time. I want to give our guests a chance to respond. Joe, is that an issue here? The increasing population is keeping wages down?
You know, I can't really answer that question. I'm not sure how big of a factor that is. I can say that, you know, like I said, we have had a decrease in, for example, the non-Hispanic white population has decreased significantly in the Milwaukee area over the last 10 years. So this population the Hispanic population has come in and filled a lot of jobs where people are retiring in the manufacturing industry and things like that. So. I can't really answer that question.
We've got about a minute left here. The disparities shown in this report can seem pretty much negative, but is there some progress that you're also seeing for this demographic?
Yes, and I should have made that definitely clear. There's been significant improvement over time in the percentage of adults with at least a high school diploma, and with the percentage who have a college degree. So those are all trending in a good direction. There's increasing college enrollment among Hispanics. So certainly there are a lot of positive trends as well. We just note that this is really important to get this population achieving at the same rate as the general population, as they're so critical to the future of the region.
And if people want to look at your report, where can they find it?
On our website, it's wispolicyforum.org, okay. And you can find it there. It's called Upward Mobility.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Up next, the news. Then we continue our conversation about wages and the economy, this time from a national perspective. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's taken a long time to see wage growth in the post-recession economy. Experts now say that inflation-adjusted wages grew in 2018, but there's a caveat. Not everyone has been included in that growth. Large gaps by race, gender, wage, and educational level not only persist, but in some cases have grown wider. What questions do you have about national economic trends? How does your current job and wage situation compare to what it was before the Great Recession? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also reach us on Twitter, the handle at WPR Mornings. Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Her areas of expertise include wages, economic mobility, and jobs. She recently authored a piece titled State of Working America Wages. Elise, welcome to The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
It's been 10 years since the Great Recession. I don't know what was great about it. Wages are steadily rising across the country. Is it unusual that it's taken so long for wages to catch up with the economy?
In some ways, it is. It is unusual. I think that particularly when people look at the unemployment rate, which has been at or below 4% for over a year now, people think, well, then what happened? Why are wages lagging so much behind? And I think there's a couple of reasons for it, right? We know the recession was deep and people are just sort of finally getting back on their feet. Job losses were great. And the unemployment rate, I think, has been overstating the strength of the labor market in some way. There are many people that were sidelined by the Great Recession that sort of gave up looking actively for work, and then they weren't counted among the official unemployed. And you see every month, pretty much steadily, people are coming back into the labor force looking for jobs. Lots of them are getting jobs. And so now that pickup is going to translate into stronger wage growth. But it just took a very long time.
A rising tide is supposed to float all boats, isn't it? But that didn't happen.
That's right. I think what happened is that when so many people lost their jobs and then they started returning, right, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, things were still pretty weak. And as it's gotten stronger, people feel just lucky enough to hold on to their job, not good enough that they can go to their boss and ask for a raise. Employers are used to being able to set those contracts because the workers are just, again, feeling just lucky enough to have that job. And I think that that has put more power in the hands of employers. And that's why we're not seeing wage growth rise.
So factors like the strength of the economy and unemployment levels, how do they impact wage rates?
Well, generally, we think about you have a stronger position vis-a-vis your employer if there are fewer workers out there looking for a job. If an employer knows that they can replace you easily, then they have no need to pay you more or give you better benefits. But if they know that workers are more scarce and they can't easily replace you, then they're going to do a little bit more to try to attract and retain the workers that they can. And so that gives them those workers a little bit more leverage to bid up their wages. So if there's a lot of workers sidelined and you know that they're sidelined, whether or not they're officially counted in the employed, then they're not as scarce, and any one worker is not as valuable. Does that make sense?
Perfectly. Let's take a phone call here. Bernie is with us in Elkhorn. Bernie, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. Good to be on. I recently read an article by Paul Craig Roberts, and he was a PhD in economics. He was an editor at the Wall Street Journal. He was an assistant secretary of the Treasury under Reagan. And he's written many times about the big hit to American workers began after the Reagan administration when the offshoring began. And millions upon millions, tens of millions of factory jobs and others went overseas. And now he's written that the next hit that the workers in America are going to take is going to be because of robotics. That robotics are going to be another devastating hit. And that he's questioning the official statistics, both under Trump, under Obama, and going back, that the jobs that are being created are not really middle-class sustaining jobs for the most part. They're kind of in the service sector. But the robotics is the point I wanted to make, and the offshoring.
Hey, Bernie, thanks for your call. Elise, what about it? Offshoring, robotics, those have all been unhelpful for wage earners in the U.S.?
It's certainly true that there are many factors that have led to wage growth not being as strong, not just in the aftermath of the Great Recession, but also over the last 40 years. Workers have lost a lot of bargaining power vis-a-vis their employers, the loss of unions, the declining value of the minimum wage, degraded labor standards in general. In the most recent period, we're seeing things like workers having to sign non-compete agreements. And one of the best ways that workers can get higher wages is they get another offer. And if they're excluded from being able to get another offer, then they often don't have the ability to get higher wages. So there's many factors. And so speak to the sort of technology robots. I think that it is often you hear it out of the rhetoric out there about how robots are going to take our jobs. And I think that that is overstated. We've seen technological advances, great technological advances over the last 100 years. And people have thought, oh, what's going to happen? All the jobs are going to disappear. And slowly there are ways in which workers and employers have adjusted to those big technological changes. And yes, there will be some shifting around, but that's not, I don't think it's enough to think the sky is falling about that. There are all sorts of ways the economy will accommodate that. And I don't think it's nearly as big as many people are worried about.
Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us from Valley Junction. Jimmy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Morning. Yeah, I'd say the part of the probably one of the biggest issues is the continued erosion of labor unions in the country and Supreme Court decisions like the Janus decision and the course in Wisconsin. We had 8 years of Scott Walker destroying unions, and I just think that if you don't have a group that can get together and negotiate as a group instead of an individual, let's say Walmart, let's say they were unionized, you see a lot better wages and benefits there, and that would lift the wages because they're a big employer.
Jimmy, thanks so much for that. Elise, unions, the absence of unions means very little bargaining power then for the average worker, right?
That's exactly right. We've seen over the last 40 years or so a decline in unions, and not because people don't want them. Surveys show that the majority of workers actually want to be in a union, but a lot of employer opposition tactics have made it harder and harder for workers to be in unions. So at the same time we've seen this decline in unions, we've seen this rise in inequality. And it's no surprise that those things are absolutely related.
So what types of workers are being impacted by the uptick in wage growth? What areas are wages really growing?
Well, what we're seeing, I think the positive thing that we're seeing in the economy over the last couple of years is actually some stronger wage growth for those workers at the bottom. Yes, we're continuing to see wage growth at the top. That growing inequality, that growing concentration of not only wages but incomes and wealth, that continues. So that story is absolutely there as well. But this growth at the bottom has been particularly a positive sign in the economy today. So, and that's due to two things. One, we know low-wage workers are the ones that are hurt the worst in the Great Recession, in recessions in general. those lower wage workers are the ones that are batted around more. They don't have that leverage or that bargaining power, and they're often let go in weaker times. And so when we see those jobs coming back and we see those workers seeing some wage growth, those are the workers that are going to be disproportionately positively impacted when the unemployment rate continues to fall. The second thing that's happened for them is that there have been statewide minimum wage increases across the country over the last several years, and that impacts about half of the – in states that about half of the workers live. And so you're seeing this big – rise that's happening a little bit at a time across the states, and that has an impact on low-wage workers' wages as well. Again, as the federal minimum wage has stayed where it's been for a few years, states have acted. And so the growing economy and these minimum wage increases mean that low-wage workers are getting a boost today.
And some specific cities have increased their minimum wage, and of course the argument there is, well, everybody's just going to leave and they aren't going to put up with this and all of that. Are we seeing that for those states and municipalities where they've raised the minimum wage? Has there been a negative side effect of that, of businesses leaving?
Not that I've seen, no. I mean, when you remember who a lot of minimum wage workers are, they're working in the service sector, so they're going to be working in hospitality industries, you know, restaurants. Those are not places, what are you going to do? You're going to move? Your customers are right there. It doesn't really make sense to think about those types of workers leaving or those types of businesses leaving. So, no, as these are measured increases slowly over time, they have very little impact on employment, if at all.
Inflation-adjusted wages grew for most workers in 2018, but we're looking at some gaps here. Where are the gaps and how persistent are they?
So the worst gap that I found in my research and that we've seen other researchers out there, my colleagues Valerie Wilson has found this as well, and William Rogers, and there are other people out there who have pointed out this black-white wage gap between black and white workers of different education levels, of different wage levels, that has grown. And that has grown significantly over the last couple of decades. And so that is the most problematic sign, I would have to say, that I've seen in this research of late, is that black-white wage gaps have actually gotten worse.
We use the unemployment rate a lot when we talk about the economy. What exactly is that measuring here? We've got about 30 seconds before we have to go to a break.
So the unemployment rate specifically looks at those workers who don't have a job but are actively looking for work. So they looked in the last 4 weeks, and those are the only workers that are counted in the official unemployment rate.
Okay, and as you pointed out earlier, there are a lot of people who just stopped looking. Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Her areas of expertise include wages, economic mobility, and jobs. She recently authored a piece titled State of Working American Wages. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's taken a while, but we're finally starting to see some post-recession wage growth. But gaps persist. We're finding out why. Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and she recently authored a piece titled State of Working America Wages 2018. How confident are you in the strength of the economy? Have your wages grown or remained stagnant? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll hear next from Patty, who's calling us from Birchwood. Patty, hello.
Hello, good morning. I don't have much faith in the traditional economy. I think we're going to globalism, and that's okay with me. But what I'm seeing in the 20-year-olds is the sharing economy. I see young people that are graduating with debt, looking into a traditional economy that's not going to provide them with a living. And so they're rejecting materialism. Many share cars. They share housing. They're doing it out of the box. And I think that that's very hopeful. And I'm wondering if you saw any of that in your research, and I'll listen off the line.
Patty, thanks so much for your call. Elise?
Yeah, it's a great question, whether or not there's a change in the economy. What we're seeing when we look at some of the statistics on contingent workers, those workers who, you know, maybe working Uber, Lyft kinds of jobs, I think that people talk about those jobs often, it's not as big as it seems. And it seems like many people are doing this as a second job and not as their main job. So they may be piecing together different part-time jobs to try to just make ends meet, and they're, you know, working some of these other jobs, these sort of gig economy jobs on this side. And so they're not making their main job from that. And I take your point that a lot of these young workers graduating into the economy that we have today, you know, even those with a college degree, may be having a hard time finding jobs that are in their field. They may be taking jobs that don't require a college degree. Their underemployment rates are still elevated compared to where they were, you know, let's say 20 years ago. So there's many of them that are working part-time and actually want a full-time job. So I'm worried more that they may be piecing these together and working an alternative economy because that's all they have left for them, and not necessarily by choice. A lot of them are reporting that they actually want to be working full-time, and they're discouraged. And again, they're facing lots of debt in the economy today.
Yeah, I wanted to get at that debt question because it isn't just 20-somethings that have a lot of that. Pretty much everybody has a lot of personal debt, and that tends to eat up wage increases, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. When you think about what you have to spend your money on, your housing, your food, all of those basic necessities, let's say you have a childcare, all those expenses are very high. And then if you're carrying around debt, and it could be school debt, a lot of actually people who don't finish college have a lot of school debt there, but you could also still have housing debt or car debt, lots of different kinds of debt people are holding. And that makes it really hard to make ends meet and to pay off those debts and to sort of get above water.
The economy has been on a slow but steady upward trend over the last few years. Do you see that prosperity as sustainable? Is that going to continue?
I think so. I'm optimistic. It's been a slow recovery in part because the pursuit of austerity at all levels of government. There were a lot of ways in which we were restraining growth, really. We could have had a faster bounce back if we had stimulated the economy more. The Federal Reserve right now, after raising rates for a time, looks like they're holding off and letting the economy recover. There's no concerns that of any sort of inflation from wage growth. In fact, inflation's been low. I think if we keep it on this track, many workers who haven't really felt the recovery are going to start feeling it, and job growth will continue. So I am absolutely optimistic about the near future of the economy.
And hiring is often based on demand for products. I mean, companies don't hire people if they don't have the ability to sell their output. Do you see employers as having a positive view of the future in terms of what they're going to be able to do and how many people they're going to be able to employ?
Yes, I think that what you're basically saying is that the more wages we get, right, then the ability for those workers today who have more wages tomorrow to be able to buy more things, right, they'll have more demand for goods and services. They won't just be paying off their debts, but hopefully they'll be making more investments for their families, and that money circulates in the economy. So that employers then need to hire more workers to meet that increased demand for those goods and services. So that's all a virtuous cycle.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. Elise Gould is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In theory, Wisconsin's alcohol laws are grounded in a three-tier system where producers, distributors, and retailers all operate independently. In practice, the law is full of exceptions and economic protections. In WPR's ongoing series, High Tolerance, Sean Johnson has the report.
Brian Sammons knows every ingredient in the spirits he makes from scratch at his Twisted Path Distillery in Milwaukee. Sammons gets his grain from a farmer in Dodgeville. He heats it with water to form a mash, then mixes it with yeast to form alcohol. He refines the alcohol in a 300-gallon stainless steel and copper still. It's like a giant tea kettle, but a lot more complicated.
This is my vodka column. So I can redirect the vapor. I can turn those two blue handles, and the vapor coming off this will go through the 4-plate column, then the 12-plate vodka column, and then to the condenser. And that allows me to distill the bejesus out of it to make it vodka.
Sammons bottles his own spirits and serves them in the distillery's tap room. But under the complicated labyrinth of laws that regulate alcohol in Wisconsin, Salmon's control over every aspect of his business ends there. He needs someone else to distribute his spirits once they leave his building, and he could be fined or even jailed if he tries to do it himself.
There's a bar around the corner that carries my spirits. They sell drinks with my gin. If they run out of my gin on a Saturday and they call me and say, can you run some gin over? You're right around the corner. My answer would be, I'm afraid that would be 9 months in jail for me and I would lose my business.
A ban on distilleries distributing their own spirits is one of many restrictions in the world of alcohol. The laws have their roots in 1933, the year Prohibition was repealed under the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Attorney Aaron Gary drafts Wisconsin's alcohol statutes for the Nonpartisan Legislative Reference Bureau. Speaking at a recent State Bar of Wisconsin symposium on alcohol law, Gary said the idea behind the system is that it maintains independence between alcohol producers, distributors, and retailers. These are known as the three tiers.
Does Wisconsin have a strict three-tier system? It does not.
That's because the system is anything but consistent. Sometimes there are exceptions to the rules. For example, while a distiller cannot distribute their own products, a brewer can. But the law also adds restrictions. When a brewer signs contracts with distributors, they're exclusive. That means that for every brand, there can be only one distributor in a given county. If a brewer wants to fire their distributor, they have to find another distributor to buy their brand or buy it back themselves. Isaac Shawaki is the CEO of Octopi Brewing. He says distributors have grown too big and distributor laws protect the status quo.
There's nothing to push them to do a good job because if they do a terrible job with your brand and they don't sell your brand, you can't do anything about it. You can't leave. Because if you say, I want to terminate my contract, then they're going to tell you, okay, pay us like an insane amount of money.
Distributors have consolidated over the years, growing larger. Take Frank Beverage Group. Mike Frank, president of Frank Beer Distributors in Middleton, has about 500,000 cases of beer on his warehouse floor, including well-known brands like Miller Coors and New Glarus.
I've added it up. I think it's 700 pallets of New Glarus, roughly 30,000 cases.
Between this warehouse and the others Frank Beverage Group owns, they'll sell about 16.5 million cases of beer this year. By Mike Frank's estimates, that's about one in every four cases of beer sold in Wisconsin. Mike's dad, Steve Frank, helped restart their beer distribution business years ago. He disputes the idea that the laws protecting distributors remove their incentive to sell beer.
We have to sell it. It's in our best interest to sell it. It's our best interest to make sure it moves through.
Steve Frank says state law protects distributors because they're making investments in the brands they sell.
There's a value and a worth to what we are selling, even if we're not selling as much as they think we should be selling.
The Franks say the proof is in crowded retailer aisles, filled with more options than ever before. But getting to those shelves can be a challenge for a brewery, winery, or distillery, and the laws make it more difficult for some, depending on where they start. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, WPR will look at the politics behind how Wisconsin's alcohol laws get written. You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Just ahead, often moments in our lives where words fail us. We'll talk about that. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show.